You must say these words. Klaatu, Varada, Nikto. Please repeat that.
Klaatu, Varada, Nikto.
You must remember those words.
Good. Klaatu, Varada, Nikto. Klaatu, Varada, Nikto.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard! Our guest today is Tobias S. Bakel, whose new novel, A Stranger in the Citadel, is out now from Tachyon Publications. Welcome to Retro Rockets. Can you introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about you?
Hi, I'm Tobias Bakel. I'm a Caribbean-born science fiction author. I was born in Grenada and spent time in the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, where I went to school before eventually ending up in Northwest Ohio. I've written 50 novels and 130 short stories that have been published and are out there.
I knew you had written a ton of novels and some short stories. Give me that number again of short stories.
It adds up, doesn't it?
It's
130
does.
Short stories, 100 of them published in various professional magazines and anthologies and things like that. And then about 30 that came out through my Patreon directly to users that have been like reprinted in some short story collections or reprinted in magazines or anthologies elsewhere. So 130 stories that I've been paid professional rates for up to this point.
That is inspirational.
Thank you. Many, many years ago, I asked Jeff Landis when I was getting started out in my very, you know, had my first like three short stories sold. I asked Jeff Landis, like, how did you sell 100 short stories? And he says, like, you know, just like three or four every year. It adds up. Eventually you get there.
Wow. I'm going to be spending most of our time talking about your new novel that's out. But before we get to that, you've got some short story collections. That's all your work. What are those titles of those collections so our listeners can find you?
Absolutely. The latest short story collection was Zen and the Art of Starship Maintenance and Other Stories. And that's like all kind of spacey science fiction short stories, you know, the things that kind of got me hooked into this genre when I was a teenager to begin with. And then a year ago, Shoggoths in Traffic and Other Stories came out. And that's kind of a collection of like fantasy short stories. So the themes of each are just stuck to the genre.
I love it. So you've got a new novel out from Tachyon called A Stranger in the Citadel. And the story takes place, or at least it begins, in a city where the population has given up on learning new things. And they can't read books, and it just sounds very, very icky to me. Because you can't see it, and our listeners can't see it, but like I'm in a room surrounded by books right now. What inspired you to tell this particular story, and what kind of things were you thinking about as the story came together?
Absolutely. This one was an interest. There is like a whole tale behind the tale here. I run some generative exercises for new writers where I kind of show them how we can mechanically be our own GPT. We could take some of our favorite things like tropes and cliches and sayings, and we can kind of grab them and we can kind of just plug in new words just to see if we can spark something, you know, and we can mash things together to see if that sparks something. And in one of those, I was doing a take a famous phrase and regenerate it type exercise for some students. And I took Thou Shalt Not Suffer a Witch to Live as mine to see if I could make something more interesting out of it. And I plugged in the word eventually librarian. I was just trying different things. Thou shalt not suffer a fisherman to live, you know. Thou shalt not suffer, you know. And when I hit librarian, I kind of, you know, the goosebumps on the back of the neck go up and I went, ooh, there's something there. And I started to mull over just what else, what else can I get out of that phrase? At the same time, I was thinking a lot about the ending of Fahrenheit 451. At the end of Fahrenheit 451, they they all, that the act of resistance and the bright light at the end of the dark tunnel of that book is supposedly the end, where they all gather together and they're memorizing a chapter so that they can get together and recite the books that are being burned. And for me, it was not a hopeful ending because I'm ADHD and dyslexic and I love weird science fiction books. And I was just like, I don't know if people will commit to memorizing some of my favorite books, you know? And as someone who can't memorize for squat, I just thought, well, this is a disaster waiting to happen. And I thought about the game of telephone, the way meaning gets distorted as it gets passed down from person to person. So it felt very, you know, the end of Fahrenheit 451 to me feels like a horror novel. It left me despondent. And it was years and years later. I come from an oral tradition of storytelling in the Caribbean. Like, not that I come from it as in like I was a great griot or anything, but like I listened to griots. I listened to aunties telling stories. I listened to Paul Keynes Douglas, who was a famous oral storyteller on the radio all the time. So I was, you know, grew up in that. And one of my friends studies a bit of oral tradition and pointed out that there are correcting mechanisms within oral tradition that keep the story from wandering off and losing its inherent meaning, which is the community acts as kind of like a checksum, which tells the storyteller whether they got the story right or not. And we have these examples of First Peoples from Australia. Knowing details about volcanic eruptions and getting them right that are 10,000 years old. So the story has inherently carried and been held for 10,000 years. And that blows my mind. And so that kind of makes the end of Fahrenheit 451 a little bit more nuanced for me when I discovered this and kind of got back to my roots a little bit. So I wanted to write about a post-literate future and demonstrate that stories don't die. We still know about like Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Important stories still can live, even if like the overall amount of story gets lost, right? And that we would presumably not lose these stories. And as I read history, I just keep seeing these renaissances that come after dark periods, right? So we have these collapses. We have, you know, the burn, you know, there have been civilizations that banned and burned all the books. And then another civilization will take them and hold on to them, which is why libraries in general are so important. And then like, you know, that Renaissance always comes out of this receding of the old books that were, you know, and old knowledges that were destroyed. And so all of that kind of came together. And I wanted to write about kind of this world, you know, where all books have been, you know, banned and given up in this, you know, exchange, and about how that wouldn't make a difference. That we would still persevere in seeking out knowledge and truth, and it was always there for us to find, and that in stories would stay with us. So that, you know, it feels dystopian when people are like, it's a, you know, world in which all books are banned and burned. But I just wanted to look at the fact that like readers are going to be, you know, constantly fighting back against that.
And we're constantly looking for stories and looking for knowledge. And I loved what you said a moment ago about how the corrective measures, where when a storyteller is telling a story with an audience, the audience's reaction or some other type of interaction is going to tell the storyteller if they're doing it right. And it's a two-way communication. And in a way, when I'm reading a book, it's only one-way communication. So yeah. It's something that the oral tradition has that, you know, me being surrounded by books and reading books all the time, I'm actually missing out on that.
Where the communal function is missing. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I thank you for giving all of that backstory. That was really fascinating. I never
always call you in media training. It's supposed to be short bites, but I'm just sort of like, ah, here's the whole thing.
No, it was magnificent. I never know what I'm going to get when I ask that question. And this was like a dream answer. So thank you.
Thank you.
So the story follows a young woman named Lilith. And, you know, she lives in this city where there's, you know, there's storytelling, but there's no books. And I read somewhere that, but outside her city in other communities, and to be clear, this is a science fiction story. We're in the future. We have colonized another planet. And so there's people living in different areas on this planet. So in communities outside the city, there is books and there is librarians and there is reading. How come people who live in one area of this planet get to have books and libraries and all of that stuff, but people inside the city aren't allowed to have that?
So the books are banned just everywhere, but what we have are some people who are the resistance. So the library is New Alexandria, because of course, and that's a place that has sprouted up in defiance and is kind of, you know, holding books and training readers and creating librarians and sending them out into the world. But most of the rest of the place is, you know, not down with this. So to be a librarian is a very dangerous thing. So they're out there, they're carrying their books around on ponies or whatever, and, you know, trying to get out there and infect the rest of the world with reading. And everyone else's guards are up, you know. So in Nineveh, you know, and we mainly deal with Nineveh and a couple other towns around it, are without books. And it's our character Ishmael who kind of comes in out of the wastes, you know, with some books and, in, you know, tries to kind of spread a little bit of chaos and knowledge.
Do people know how to read?
They do not.
Okay.
They do not. It's all very, it's mysterious. There's even a section of the book where one of the characters realizes that a bunch of the decorations she's seeing in another town is just ancient writing. She kind of, you know, at first mistakes it for just decoration, and then later on realizes after she's had some knowledge and teaching that actually she's looking at words.
Oh, that is so cool. That's like giving me goosebumps.
Yeah, yeah. But generally, yeah, it's the markings are considered dangerous. You know, ink is considered, you know, problematic, only for drawing. And when they burn books, they're really worried about inhaling, you know, the magic of writing.
You went all out of, you know, if we can't even inhale the smell of this burning stuff.
You don't know how it works. So, like, you know, you got to be careful.
And I love that there's this mix of, you know, the fantasy elements of we think this is magic. We think this is a bad magic. We're scared of this because we don't understand it. But also a science fiction backdrop of, you know, once upon a time, these people had a spaceship and they got to this planet and they were able to make this planet habitable for people and grow crops and do whatever else they were going to do. How did you go about mixing science fictional elements and fantasy elements together?
So this is a real classic tradition of doing that in our field. Like, I think like somewhere in like the 80s and 90s, we got really serious about genre separations. And we're like, no, we can't, you know, we don't want to mix our fantasy with our science fiction. But like some of these great, great, you know, pieces, like, I mean, you don't have Star Wars without like magical force, right? You know, there are these great classic pulp examples of science fantasy in our genre. And so I've always been a bit of a purist in separating my genres. I'm writing alternate history here. But in this case, one of the subgenres I love are books that start as fantasy and feel fantasy. And then as you get further and further into it, you realize that actually it's science fiction. My favorite example of that is Carl Schrader's Ventus. But some of the other, like, we're going to spoil a whole lot of books for people, but like, you know, Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe is very famously like for books and books and books is science, fantastical. And then you find, as you get deeper and deeper into it, you find out, and by the way, I haven't read Book of the New Sun yet, so I'll probably get shot by some really, excited science fiction fan out there. But I know this from talking to lots of people who love those books, that like, there's that mystery of just finding out like what it really is as you get deeper and deeper into it.
It took me, took me like my third read through to figure out wait a minute, this is this. And, and like, that's what I look for now when I'm rereading is those, minute, this I think is really going to be this. And oh my goodness, is this? And it's become a fun game for me.
The detective, you know, inspector part of being a genre reader sometimes is very fun. So in this case, I did want to kind of create this big reveal because, you know, it feels kind of like a second world fantasy. And then there's a big reveal in the book, you know, kind of give away some stuff here where they kind of realize that, you know, where they are and what this world is and how it works. And kind of like, you know, and it's a very science fictional reveal, right? They just don't have access to all the information. I just love moments like that. Although I was just talking to someone who said that they were really surprised I did that at the end of the first third of the book. Because they're like, many writers would have done that at the very end of the book, the big reveal that I did. And I was just like, eh.
No, I like having it.
Let it go.
I like having that stuff a little bit earlier, because then there's so much fun in seeing how the characters react to...
It's the implications.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, yes, it's super duper fun to do the big reveal 5 pages before the end. And yes, that's very fun. But then I'm always like, okay, where's book two? Because I'm interested in the implications. I'm interested in the consequences. I'm interested in the different ways that different characters are going to react to things. That's really fun.
That's how I felt. And I often get frustrated when there's a big reveal at the end and you're like, this changes everything. And there's no more to read. Like, you know, I hate Hollywood stuff where they're like, this science fiction idea that you're really used to, because you're literate and you've read a lot, is going to be the very end, you know, because it's like, you know, oh, look, they're really all on a spaceship in like cyber sleep. And you're like, okay, that's the beginning.
Exactly. There was a miniseries that was out on TV, I don't know, 5 or 8 years ago. And of course, I can't remember the name of it. But there is a big reveal, and they do it in like episode 3. Which makes the rest of it, I think the whole thing was like 12 episodes or something. And it makes the rest of it really fascinating, because as a viewer, it was, does that character know what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, they don't know, and that's why they're doing these idiotic things. Or they do know, and that's why they're manipulating this other person. And it was just so fun.
Yeah, like a good switcheroo like that in like the first few episodes just delights me.
Yes. Oh, so thank you for putting the reveal, you know, earlier in the book so we can all have fun with it afterwards.
Yeah. Plus, I think it's also interesting. It's more like, I think it's more chewy on character side to kind of show more of like you said, like their reactions, how this affects them.
Because
I think a part of why we read is to sort of walk a mile on someone else's feet. And I always just feel a little bit cheated when we don't get that kind of like, well, how is this going to change their lives kind of beats. Like, I get the idea is really cool, but I'm like, I'm reading it because I'm enjoying being in this person's head.
Yeah, it's like I'm enjoying, I feel exactly the same way. I'm enjoying, you know, how is this person reacting to change? Are they reacting to change the same way I would react to change? Or are they reacting in a completely different way? And either I like it or it's freaking me out. And it's just really fun. It's, you know, we all have things in our life that we don't want those things to change. And when you're reading a character going through a huge change, it's like... it makes our changes feel a little bit less scary, I guess. I'm not explaining that very well.
No, that's okay. Yeah, that's, I get that. Like, it's comparing your problems to a literary character's problems.
Exactly.
Often kind of give you that like space you need to be like, I think I'm going to be okay. You know, like my uncle hasn't locked me in a tower.
Or, you know, I don't have to walk across a post-apocalyptic United States. So I guess having that 8 a.m. Monday meeting is really not that bad.
Or, right, you know, I've got air conditioning, man. I'm going to be fine.
I'm going to be fine. I have air conditioning. I have coffee. Everything's going to be just fine.
I was just telling someone else this weekend that one of the reasons I think I got sucked into science fiction in particular and love it so much is scale, right? So it's just scale of problems, scale of time, scale of size, you know, the great big objects. I love, you know, big dumb objects in science fiction so much. And so it's just like those things are just... delight me so much. And again, it just kind of puts you into perspective. And that's always just really good for, I think, the ego.
I like that too. I liked, at a young age, I got sucked into space opera. And it's still a love of mine. And it, you know, as a teenager, it was this person is traveling from, you know, from Earth to Neptune. And, you know, okay, sure, it takes them a week to get there, but that is so cool. And it's a scale yeah. thing, because then when I actually, yeah. and then when I actually look at the numbers, it's, wow, that's really far away. The solar system is yeah. really big, and I am yeah. really small, and it's
and
good.
The best writing is when someone can like make you feel that, mm-hmm. you know, that just sense of scale. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm always like, ah. I did a short story once where I get to like, I get to use the phrase, you know, coming in above the plane of the ecliptic, you know, and just kind of establishing like a scale as the opening of the story, and that mm-hmm. just. It just made me very happy. It was like, this is why I got into writing and loving these stories.
You're listening to Retro Rackets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Today, our guest is Tobias S. Bakel, author of A Stranger in the Citadel. You can listen to this and other episodes at retrorocketpodcast.podbean.com. Retro Rackets is also on Blue Sky. Come say hi. At retrorockets.bsky.social. I wanna talk about. We were talking about characters and changes that characters sure. go through. So tell me about some of the other characters in A Stranger in the Citadel, and just like what are they facing? And I don't know if we can do this without spoilers. But what are they facing? And like. How do they get through it?
So yeah, you know, fundamentally in this novel, I'm kind of looking at lots of different problems, right? Like the reason that reading gets banned is because artificial intelligences, you know, godlike technological powers discover that, you know, they've decided to kind of create like a reserve for humanity, and they offer up. You know, this system of cornucopias that will produce any medicine or food or, you know, need that you want, and put us in a giant park, you know, a la, you know, like the Matrix or whatever. And that, you know, that's supposed to take care of the human problem. And we agreed to, you know, let go of like knowledge and science and reading in order to go into this.
Living in a nature preserve?
You know, created by godlike beings. It's a whole other structure world, right? And so, you know, I just wanted to explore the fact that, like, you know, for some of this book, it shows that knowledge is power, right? There's someone who has a secret book, and that gives them the power to create gunpowder, which gives them the power to oppress people around them and create a kind of like feudal system. And that's real, right? Information arbitrage allows us to gain power over others. And all of that came out of a book and knowledge, right? So we can use knowledge to oppress others. And that's true. That's a thing that we do as human beings. And that, you know, that goes away when the gods kind of take reading and knowledge seeking away from us. And this is kind of shown. So I'm, you know, not that I believe that, you know, this is true. I'm definitely like pro book, pro knowledge. But like, I did want to show that, like, I get where the concern comes from, right? Like, there wouldn't be so many people excited about banning books if there wasn't kind of some impulse in us to wonder about what stories should and shouldn't be told, right? Like, I have this constant debate within myself about, like, you know, the idea of Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler sitting on a bookshelf somewhere, right? Like, on the one hand, we should read it to understand those odious beliefs and where they come from, because so many people read them and adopt them. And so, like, preparation is, like, half this battle. On the other hand, like, if someone were to, like, ban Mein Kampf, like, how serious would I be about, like, trying to stop that? I wouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, I would just be like, well, that's really sad. You know, like...
You wouldn't fight for it.
I wouldn't fight for it, right? And what is that? You know, so like I have this two wolves inside of me type thing, right? Where I'm kind of going like, oh, crap, you know, like I can see the edge case, even though I'm kind of like 100% pro-library and pro-books, you know. And if I see Mein Kampf sitting in a collection of books, I don't make an assumption about who's reading it necessarily, right? Because we have to read these horrible things in order to understand them. And I'm a seeker of knowledge. And so I just end up in this kind of like, you know, circular loop. So I wanted to put that in the book as well, to show that knowledge can be dangerous and can lead people down the wrong path. But I also have, you know, the librarian who comes in and gives knowledge and is seeking knowledge and, you know, and arguing with the people who have just received, you know, traditions and just kind of getting in there and just trying to look at all the stuff, you know. And at the time, book banning wasn't kicking off in such a big way. I was writing this during a period of, you know, the right in America was going on about free speech absolutism, and the left was like pro knowledge. You know, so when I was writing this, I thought I was being really esoteric.
Right.
You know, I just had this thought experiment around this idea of thou shalt not suffer a librarian to live. And it came out. And now that the print edition is coming out 2 years later, all of a sudden it's coming out in a very different book environment.
Yes, where, the timing. You know,
we have we have a politician who is burning, actually literally burning books for a campaign ad with a fire, like a, you know, fire thrower.
I'm so happy I don't have network television, and I hopefully will not see that ad, because that's just gross.
Yeah, we have all of this book banning happening, this sort of moral panic. And now the way in which this book is being looked at, because it came out first in audio 2 years ago from Audible, you know, and people talked about the story and the world building then. And now all people want to talk about is the book banning aspect of the novel. So I think, like, it's just interesting how the whole world changed, and suddenly this book lands extremely different than it did when it came out in audio 2 years ago. And now it's finally coming out in print. Ironically, there are places where it's not allowed, right? It's a book all about book banning and seeking knowledge and about this stuff. And like, and now I, like, 2 years ago, I wasn't thinking it would be prevented from being anywhere. And to be clear, I don't know if anyone has banned it yet, but just because of the subject material, I fully anticipate that this will not end up as on as many shelves as it would have 2 years ago if it had come out in print 2 years ago. And that's inherently wild and scary and weird. And so the way people are responding and sending me email about this book has changed really dramatically in the 2 years that it's been out.
Yeah, it's it kind of harkens back to that like one-way communication when someone's reading a book as opposed to hearing a story from a storyteller. And you can't control when someone reads it. Like, I mean, people are going to read this book in 15 years, and who knows what
it may land completely differently.
Exactly, exactly.
Hopefully it lands like a dud in 15 years. Hopefully in 15 years, people are like, this was a silly book.
Or hopefully it lands in 15 years and people say, these characters are so great. I really enjoy, you know, the journey these characters went on.
Yeah.
It was, I'm trying to remember if it was either Cory Doctorow or Charlie Strauss, or it could have been both of them, that they were talking about, you know, some science fiction novel that they had written, and by the time the book was published, reality had caught up.
Yeah.
And this feels a little bit like that. And I know the novel came out 2 years ago in audio, but for a lot of folks, this is going to be the first time they're seeing this title. So you were writing this manuscript in, you know, what, 2020-ish?
Yeah, 2020-ish is when I wrote it, and it came out in 2020, if I remember right.
Okay.
Yeah, or 2021.
So stuff that for you was esoteric, was science fiction, was, you know, this is ridiculous. This is a fun thought experiment. Yeah. Things have caught up, and it's
I don't like it.
It's so weird. Absolutely.
The last
weird.
Time I wrote something where this kind of feeling happened to me was my novel Arctic Rising, which is about
that's a
climate
great
change.
Novel, by the way.
Thank you. And when I was working on it, I was reading these IPCC reports, and I was reading the U.S. Navy's Task Force Climate Change report. And TFCC is like, it's wild, right? And I just remember putting the book together and thinking it was set like 100 years in the future and having a lot of specific dates in it. By the time I was revising it for publication, so many details in it that seemed far off in the future about just, you know, heavy weather, climate change, changes in geopolitics were happening, that I just stripped all the dates out. And I was just like, sometime in the near future, because dear God, this is just what looked like it would be 100 years out was crunching down to be just like 30 years out. There's stuff that I thought was wild and out there was stuff that I was suddenly realizing I was going to see in my lifetime. And that was when I went through a whole draft and took every date reference out, because I was just like, this, the future is collapsing in on this book too fast. And yeah, something really similar here happened.
Oh, wow.
For years after Arctic Rising came out, whenever some new thing about a lack of ice in the Arctic popped up in the news, people would send me the article, to the point where I was like, I don't want this.
That's got to be, you know, that's an experience that I haven't really thought about that an author would have. That, you know, of course, you're getting emails when a book comes out, but even years later, either, you know, someone read the book when it came out and now something has reminded them of it, or, you know, something happens a few years later and they're reading the book. And that's, that just has to be a really odd experience.
It's really, I mean, as a science fiction reader, it feels kind of affirming and also horrifying at the same time. The other one that really knocked me back for a loop is in Hurricane Fever, which came out in 2012, I think. In Hurricane Fever, I have a volunteer drone, sea drone attack of the Venezuelan Navy by Caribbean states, because they don't have a standing Navy as large as Venezuela's. So they use drones to take out the entire Venezuelan fleet and change the geopolitics in the area. And since Ukraine and Russia has been kicking off with so much drone activity, a lot of people who have read Hurricane Fever have been emailing me detail, like, you know, drone stuff from the Ukraine war, and just telling me like, hey, look.
And you're like, no, I don't need to see this.
Yeah, you're just kind of like, I mean, it's interesting that I kind of sat down when writing the book to just go, okay, what is a drone warfare kind of look like in terms of just changing the dynamic between small nations, large nations, large invested amounts of heavy armor and small mobile groups? But it was almost a throwaway in the book. You know, it was just kind of like, oh, this seems to be the direction things would have to go then, wouldn't it? And then just seeing it happen in real life is like, oh crap, this is scary, wild, and like I said, scarily affirming that I called it. And also, I don't want to have been right, you know, or I mean, you know, I don't want to, it just feels very heavy, you know, not that you don't want to have been right, but you just are like, this is, you know,
this is, it's, yeah.
Can the cool things I invented come true too, instead
right.
of just all the horrifying stuff?
Can we have like wonderful, like communications technology and cars that fly and all that good stuff? Why does the crappy stuff have to happen?
Exactly.
But I mean, it's like that is the fun, beautiful danger of being in this genre, is the thought experiments, even when they have scary parts. That's the fun part, is just playing with those thought experiments of, hey, what about this? What if this happened? What would happen?
Mostly that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to, like, you know, poke at the future a bit and see if anything falls out.
Oh, I love
and
that phrase.
It's not that we're trying to do any of this. We're just trying to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, like, I get this feeling, that meme, which is like, you know, science fiction writer, here's a really horrible thing that we shouldn't invent in the future. You know, tech billionaire from Silicon Valley. Hey, I wrote this really cool idea from a science fiction novel about a thing that we should try and invent.
And
science fiction writer,
it's
that's
like,
not what I meant.
Exactly, science fiction writer, that's not what I meant. Had you kept reading, you would have learned that that was a terrible idea.
It's just, one reason why we need more humanities everywhere.
Yes, oh my goodness, yes. And changing gears just a tiny bit, because we're going to run out of time here in a little bit. You've been doing a lot of teaching lately. You've been doing classroom teaching. You've been doing some online workshops, just all sorts of really cool writing, teaching with students and new authors, and just really, really wonderful stuff. What's that been like for you?
I have surprised myself by being really, by actually really enjoying teaching. I'm teaching undergrad for my day job right now. I kind of came in from the freelancing cold and got a job as a creative writing instructor. So working with lots of students, I'm trying to improve their writing. I really liked being in the classroom. the admin stuff is as in any job is, yeah. But I really love being in the classroom and working with the students, whether it's undergrad, grad, or one-off workshops, teaching at Clarion, just trying to help people figure out what they're aiming for with their fiction and take it up to the next level just makes me actually very happy. And now that I'm, been doing this for 25 years, I feel like after 25 years, I've got enough tools to kind of maybe be a halfway not horrible instructor.
I bet you're a fantastic instructor.
Thank you. It's fun. I've been having a lot of fun in the classroom, and the universe keeps rewarding me with more opportunities. So, to some extent, when I was younger, I just resisted this and resisted this and resisted this. And then finally, I was just like, well, if that's what the universe keeps offering me, I will do this.
Yeah, if the opportunities keep coming, you might as well give it a try and see if you like it.
Yeah, and it's been really neat. I've gotten some very nice cards from students who've taken my classes, and so that feels, warm and fuzzy and affirming inside.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. I feel like I'm going to have to take a creative writing class pretty soon here. I'm finishing up an online master's degree, an MBA. So oh, cool. It's just a million papers on boring yet interesting things. But my goodness, I've had to throw all creativity out the window to write these businessy, write a marketing plan, just describe these finance concepts. So to me, the topics are interesting, but the papers are just so boring.
And we depend as teachers so much on assigning papers, which, the only good thing I've seen about the ChatGPT revolution is that it generates a halfway decent 500-word academic essay. So I think humanities professors the world all over are going to have to reconstitute their pedagogy a little bit to fix the over-reliance, I would say, on assigning 500-word papers.
There was an article that I read recently where, and I don't recall what class the professor was teaching. So I don't know if it was a technical writing class or a creative writing class, where he had all of the students, they had to have ChatGPT write the paper, and they had to write the paper themselves and turn both of them in. And the whole point of it was, see how it's different.
Yep. I've got that same exercise in my file, and I'm considering it for one of my possible entries. I do a lot of using ChatGPT to generate crappy first drafts that they improve.
I love so that's I take a good
samples
way to use
of ChatGPT
it.
Writing. Yeah. Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
Because I think classically in humanities or writing classes, we tend to give them really great essays that are published and at the top of the form. And we're like, write like this. But it's actually a lot easier to teach writing by giving them crappy writing and just turning them into little editors, right? Like, here, make this better. Spot the things that you can make this better with. There's a lot of learning and leveling up that happens when I have them do that.
That is fantastic. Real quick, tell us where we can find you online. What's your website? Do you have any social media you want to share?
www.tobiasburkell.com is where it all happens. And sometimes I'm on Blue Sky, but I'm really trying to limit my social media these days because, tech billionaires.
I hear that. Thank you so much for being on Retro Rockets. This was really, truly wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets.
Thank you.